All right, well, take your Bibles and open to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We're going to spend a bulk of our time there, and then we'll be a bunch of other places after that. But for those of you who haven't been following along, we've been in this series, not a usual series for us. A topical series on romance. We've called it Wisdom for Dating. Looking forward to getting back into our exposition of 1 Peter, but this is a necessary and I think hope beneficial series for us this summer. And just a quick review. We've already laid some groundwork now. I think this is part three for how we ought to think about romantic or dating relationships in those first two principles or words of biblical wisdom. You remember, romantic relationships are important to God, so that's number one. He has something to say about them, and they do matter to Him. And then yet, number two, they are not more important than God. So we have to put our romantic relationships and desire for those things in their proper place. Those were our first two principles. Last time, then, part two, we looked primarily, you remember, at Genesis chapter 2, the first ever romantic relationship, the prototypical romantic relationship, you could say, and in Adam and Eve. And there we drew out five more principles, words of biblical wisdom for dating. Really, this is God's design for romance to begin with, The third principle was then romantic relationships are a part of God's good design from the very beginning. It was pre-fall. Number four, the blessing of romance is to be enjoyed according to God's will. You remember, even in the garden, even before sin enters, God gives Adam and Eve a command and a prohibition, and yet all the things to enjoy. And so we learned from that the blessing of romance is to be enjoyed according to God's will. It's not just that they have free reign and can do whatever they want outside of what He desires. No, they have to follow God's blueprint for their existence in order to truly experience the blessing of what we would even call marriage. Not only that, five, romantic relationships, we said, are intended for ministry. Remember, one of those commands that God gives Adam is cultivate and keep. Perform the work that I've given to you, delegated to you on the earth. You are to carry out my will, and you need help for that. So I give you a wife. I build you a wife. Remember, a custom-made helper for that task. So romantic relationships are intended for ministry from the very beginning. Number six, you remember God knows our relational needs better than we do. Remember Adam sitting there probably didn't realize he was in any need, right? He was probably just in awe of all that God had created for him. He had perfect fellowship with his creator. He had all the animals to keep him company. And yet God is the one who declares first that, no, you know what? You have a need. You have a need. So God designed that. He knows our need, and He meets it perfectly. So we should trust Him. And then the last one we covered was perhaps the most obvious one of all from Genesis 2, and that is romantic relationships are intended for marriage, right? We go there all the time for that passage of husband and wife. They're one flesh. They'll leave their father and mother even before any fathers and mothers were in existence. And so that is the goal, that is the blueprint, that is what God intended for romance. That's where it's to end. That's what He always pictured. And so anything that is short of that is not a desire for biblical romance. And so I hope that was helpful. Tonight, my goal is to cover two more. And we'll just dive right into them. Number eight, and that's this. Romantic relationships are not essential to the Christian life. They're not essential to the Christian life. Now, you might be asking, well, why that in a series on dating and romance? And yes, you heard that right. In other words, I could say it this way. You don't have to date. Not only that, you don't have to get married. In other words, while it is true, think about this, based on Genesis 2 and all that we looked at last time, that marriage and companionship is the norm according to God's design in this life, we should also be very quick to recognize and careful to say in a series like this that there are exceptions to that general rule. The Bible makes exceptions for that. In fact, I mean, you could just look around. Not everyone gets married. And the Bible actually says that's okay. And while we certainly want to extol the blessing of marriage in every way, we do also want to affirm that being single, listen, doesn't make you any less of a Christian, nor does it keep you from being able to fully honor Jesus in this life, nor does it keep you from being able to battle certain sins if you remain single. We have to say that. Because if we don't, we may enter marriage with wrong motives. So we have to talk about this in a series like this. The Bible says it's actually okay. There are circumstances and situations in which you could, and not only that, listen, this is interesting, should remain single. You don't have to marry, much less date, in order to have a fulfilling and useful Christian life. Some people think that life doesn't begin until they get married. Maybe you've fallen into that before. Or they can never truly be happy until they're married, or that they can't, or that God can't use them until they're married. Let me just suggest to you that those are all signs of not only wrong thinking, but potential signs that you may have, in some measure, made marriage an idol. And while marriage is absolutely to be held in honor, those thoughts are not biblical thoughts about your singleness. And we have to understand this. And part of my goal, because in this series, is not only to help you navigate dating and getting to destination marriage in a way that might please the Lord with all wisdom, but part of my goal in this series is also to give you a biblical perspective on your current season of singleness. It's hard. It would be hard to honor Christ in that season, in your current state, if you had wrong thoughts about it. And so there is a danger to imagining that singleness is a bad state that we need to get out of as quickly as possible. That's not true. Neither is it helpful. In fact, if you think about it biblically, the Bible says that you will spend the most of your existence from now into eternity, you understand? Get this, as a single person. Do you realize that? Marriage, the Bible says, is something that God meant for this earthly existence only. It's a temporary reality, or as John Piper would say, it's a momentary marriage and will not exist in heaven. I'll give you one passage. Luke chapter 20, verses 34 and 35. Jesus says, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage." Listen, in heaven, you know, with our glorified bodies, in the eternal state, I don't know if you ever realized this, but you will not be married in that state. You might have a long, fruitful marriage in this life. And I've heard people joke about it to their spouses that we may not be married in heaven, but I'm going to follow you around. And that may be true, but the reality is, listen, you won't be married in heaven. So let it be noted in this series on dating that remaining in your singleness is not the worst thing that could happen to you after all. Otherwise, heaven would be a perpetual hell for you if you made marriage an idol, right? Singleness is not the worst thing. Let's be clear about that. Now, to be sure, there are plenty of bad reasons to avoid dating. And here's just a few that I can think of. It's just too awkward. Now, that may be true for some of us, but that's not a good reason. Or it's just too much work. Too much trouble. Frankly, that's also a selfish reason. Or we avoid it because of the fear of rejection or hurt. We've had poor experiences in the past, or maybe we just have insecurities about the future. That's not a biblical reason to refrain from dating. We fear what others will think. That's just a fear of man. Maybe we're too proud and we have unrealistic expectations and no one is ever good enough to date us. That's also not a good reason. But I do believe there are some good reasons to avoid dating. And this list is much shorter, but you could boil it down to two reasons. One temporary and one permanent, okay? Either you aren't ready for marriage and you should avoid it for a season, okay? Maybe not permanently, but you should avoid it for a season. I think that's a good reason that your own character needs to be worked on in order for it to be wise for you to be joined to another. But then secondly is what I really want to talk about in this point is, and that is that there is a category in which there are people who never actually want to be married, even after they're informed biblically of what it is. And that's what we sometimes call this gift of singleness. They're content in their singleness, and in fact, they desire that to be devoted to Christ in service to Him. That's what we're talking about. It's the second one that I want to clarify under this principle. Romantic relationships are not essential to the Christian life. Because a very common and natural question comes up all the time at this point. Well, if dating is for marriage, then what if I don't want to get married? After all, if you're telling me the implication from Scripture is that romantic relationships are for marriage and should end there, then what if I don't want to be married? Should I basically resolve never to have any romance in my life, never to date? And honestly, my short answer is yes. Because the whole point of dating is to test a friendship for the possibility of marriage. In other words, biblically, you can't say that you want romance but you don't want marriage. That's not helpful. It's not a category the Bible gives to you. That would be like saying you want the benefits of marriage, but you don't want the commitment of marriage. And you already know where that, you can already see where that would go wrong. That's actually a selfish, worldly perspective. It's simply using romance for your own desires. And that doesn't please the Lord. It doesn't work that way, as we discussed last time. So if you find yourself desiring romance at the most basic level, then chances are you actually do desire marriage at some point, and that's okay. But But then there is this category, we have to say then very quickly, there is the category of people that don't desire that. And that's also okay. But in order to deal biblically with the issue, we do have to consider for a moment, what if someone truly doesn't desire marriage or romance? That's this gift of singleness. Maybe you're familiar with 1 Corinthians 7, where this idea comes from. The phrase itself, the gift of singleness, doesn't actually show up here. But it's labeled that at times because, like the gift of marriage, this permanent state of singleness is also, you'll see here in a moment, what Paul says he calls a gift from God. It's given by him. But actually, before we look at 1 Corinthians 7, I should have told you to turn to Matthew 19. Look at Matthew 19 real quick first. Keep your hand in 1 Corinthians 7. Look at Matthew 19 first. After Jesus finishes rebuking the Pharisees about their loose view on divorce, he, in Matthew 19, teaches about the God-designed commitment of the marriage relationship. And after the disciples hear what that's like, you know, because the Pharisees had just this, they just divorced anybody they wanted, right? At a drop of a hat. They burn my toast, I divorce you. That's literally what happened. And Jesus is correcting that here and saying, no, actually, let me put marriage up where God intended for it to be. And when he gets done teaching about that, here's God's standard for the commitment of marriage. God actually hates divorce. The disciples are sitting there. Here's the context of this, what we're about to read in verse 10. The disciples are sitting there thinking, man, that is a high standard. But notice verse 10. So then, notice what they say to him then in response to that. If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. You see, they're swinging the pendulum, aren't they? Now listen to Christ's response in verses 11 and 12. He said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. You see that? There's language of, this is a gift from God. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men, and there are also, notice this, eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. You see, Jesus' answer to them is this. Yes, this is a high standard, and for that reason, not all people are built for marriage. There is a category of people. Well, first of all, notice, here we have our first two clues as to what this gift of singleness actually looks like in the Scriptures. Okay, first, notice here, this gift is given by God. You see, whether it's given by God providentially in the first two categories of eunuchs who were born that way or made that way by men, whether this is a singleness for the rest of your life because you were made a eunuch at birth or someone did something to you in God's providence, or you did that to yourself willingly, that last category, whatever the case, this is given by God. And then secondly, this gift, you could say, this gift of singleness, explicitly in the last category, is for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. In other words, if God hasn't gifted you with the ability to permanently commit to a spouse for his glory, then there is a sense in which Jesus is saying here that there are those who have been gifted to be permanently single for his glory. You see, the gift of singleness is not, here's where we need to start sharpening our categories. The gift of singleness is not preferring to remain single because I like to keep my options open, or because I like to play the field, so to speak, or because I don't want to be tied down for selfish reasons. Okay, list all the worldly reasons why people don't get married today. That is not the gift of singleness, at least not the biblical term here. I mean, truly, if you think about it, the same could be said about the gift of marriage. Marriage, like singleness, is not to be pursued simply for selfish reasons either. Because I selfishly don't want to be lonely for the rest of my life, or because this person just makes me feel good all the time. Those aren't good reasons to get married. Those are selfish reasons to get married. And so in the same way, you could have selfish reasons to remain single. That's not the gift of singleness. Both the gift of singleness and the gift of marriage are to be pursued for the glory of God and for greater ministry effectiveness. And both states, both conditions are gifts from God. So we have to get that straight. The difference is, to the permanently married person, God has given a companionship that makes him more useful to Christ, as we talked about before. And to the permanently single person, God has given him the gift of singleness that makes him more useful to Christ. You see that? But the purpose is the same. And though I do believe, based on God's declaration in Genesis 2, that it's not good for man to be alone, that the gift of singleness in Matthew 19 is the exception and not the rule. Okay, we do have to say that. I think statistically speaking, it is less common by God's design that someone would have this permanent gift of singleness. Though we will say something in a moment about the general sort of temporary or providential state of singleness, perhaps, since we obviously all come into this world as single people and not already paired off. But now that you have a basic category for this, turn back to 1 Corinthians 7. This is where we're going to spend, this is where Paul now elaborates on this idea of this permanent gift of singleness, or eunuchs for the kingdom, so to speak. The passage occurs in a context discussing marriage. Notice verse 1. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise, also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So just stop right there for a moment. You see, it is, now this isn't going to be an exposition of this entire chapter. I wish we had time to do that, but so there are going to be some things that we're not going to be able to answer, but notice at least it is clear from this text that the Corinthians, who were coming out of their sensually sinful pagan lifestyle, right? Temple prostitution, loose living, all that kind of stuff. It's clear that they had written to the Apostle Paul about asking how to handle their sexual desires in the context of their marriages. So he says, hey, about the things that you wrote to me, verse 1. And much like in the same letter, their conscience in regards to meat sacrifice to idols, think about this, they were being tempted to swing the pendulum again too far away from their immoral past, to the point where they were even refraining from marital intimacy. They were even thinking, man, if this is bad, then should we even be doing this as husband and wife? And we understand where a question like that could come from. And yet, so then Paul has to write back to them here and say, look, sex is not just okay in marriage. It is actually one of the reasons for marriage, one of them. It's not the main one, but it's one of them. But notice that he even commands it here as a way to serve your spouse. In other words, this is actually what God, we could put it this way. This is actually what God intended for our sexuality. Our sexuality, listen, as man and woman, was designed ultimately by God, not for ourselves primarily, but for our spouses in marriage. That's what Paul says in these first six verses. Which means, think about this then, to exercise that function outside of marriage, listen, whether you're single or you're married, is always a sin. And by the way, that is one of the greatest arguments against self-gratification as a sin. It's people say, well, it doesn't hurt anybody. Well, but that's not the point. That function is not for you. It's made for your wife. It's made for your husband. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, the husband does. Likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And you might say, well, wait a minute, what if I don't have a husband or wife? Well, exactly. Then you shouldn't be doing it. So what does this have to do with the gift of singleness? Well, notice what Paul says next in verse 7. Yet, he says, I wish that all men were even as I myself am. He's talking about his single state. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. You see, right off the bat, Paul acknowledges that he acknowledges what we've already established from Matthew 19, that even though his wish is that all men could be single like himself, whatever their marital status is, whether single or married, it is a gift from God. Whatever state you find yourself in, single or married, it is a gift from God. Marriage is a gift and singleness is a gift. Yet, he goes on to say, notice verse 8, to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I. Now, we're going to be jumping around a lot here, but similarly, just hop down to verse 25 and 26 because he says a similar thing to virgins in verses 25 and 26. Now, concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion. It is good for a man to remain as he is. That is, having never been married. That's what a virgin is in this context. So, for these categories, the unmarried, the widow, and the virgin, Paul is saying, yes, singleness is a gift, marriage is a gift, and yet, in his opinion, there is a sense in which he thinks it's better if they remain single like himself. Now, if we aren't careful, we might begin at this point to get the impression that Paul is now contradicting what we've previously said about God's design in Genesis 2, that it's actually not good for man to be single. So which is it, right? I thought God said it wasn't good for man to be alone and single, but Paul now is saying here that it is good for man to be single. What's he talking about here? Well, notice what Paul's reasoning is for saying what he says now in verses 32 through 35. Notice, but I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say to your own benefit. And notice this, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. You see, Paul is here You see what Paul is doing here? Paul's point and his reasoning is the same as we observed in Matthew 19. It's the same exact reasoning that Jesus has there. Jesus says, I understand the standard for marriage is high, and that is why not everyone can do that. And yet, if you don't do that, then, and you consider yourself a eunuch for the kingdom, it is for this purpose that you would have undistracted service to Christ. Not so you can play the field, not so you can live a loose life outside of being tied down. Paul is making the same point. The decision to remain single here, as within Matthew 19, is made for the purpose of greater gospel usefulness, undistracted devotion to ministry and to the Lord. And let's be clear here. It's not that being concerned about pleasing your spouse is bad or wrong, right? That's not Paul's point here. Otherwise, that would be idolatry if they came before the Lord. That's not what he's describing here. Otherwise, Paul would call that sinful. He doesn't call that sinful here. So it's not that it's wrong to be concerned about your spouse. In fact, you should be if you are married. Paul's point here is simply that it doesn't make it any easier for you to minister in some very practical ways. It's actually harder for you to be undistracted in your service for Christ. In other words, if you're able to go through this short life, which is already full of enough tribulations, without being bogged down and by the complication of marriage for the sake of serving Christ in a less distracted manner, Paul says you should do that, if you can do that. But notice how he turns right around in this context and qualifies that this is clearly not a moral issue of right or wrong. Verse 28, but if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Some of you are like, whew. And not only that, look back to verse 9. But this is clearly not only possible, but for some, it's not best to be single. Notice verse 9, but if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry for that category of people than to burn. And in fact, when you factor in, I'll say even this, and when you factor in Genesis 2:18, right, it's not good for a man to be alone, along with all that we've already said about God's design for marriage and sexuality, I would even add that this is probably not possible, this technical gift of singleness. It's probably not the reality or possible for most people. And that for most people, by God's design, it is not good for them to be alone, and it would be better for them to marry, as Paul says here in verse 9, than to remain single. Nevertheless, it is clear from this passage, like in Matthew 19, that for some people, listen, God has indeed uniquely gifted them with the ability to remain celibate, to offer to God undistracted service, and that is also a very good thing. And they're no less Christian because of it. Now, to be abundantly clear, because I think there is a lot of confusion at this point, especially over verse 9, I don't believe this is as simple as saying, and I've heard this reasoning before, hey, if my sexual desires are just out of control and I can't contain my lustful impulses, then I should just get married as soon as possible. I don't actually think that's what Paul's teaching. It's not that simple. I don't think that's Paul's point here, nor do I actually think that Paul would endorse that. Someone who's just failing in their battle against sin and lust and immorality. Oh, the answer? That means I don't have the gift of singleness. I better just get married so I can indulge myself in that. That's not a biblical reasoning. That's not gospel logic. That's not where Paul goes. That's not what Paul is saying. Paul is not contradicting what the rest of the Bible teaches about sex in the husband and wife relationship. He's not now putting a stamp of approval on sinful desires and an inability to refrain from those things. Remember the context here, especially back to the verse, the first five verses of this chapter. Paul is actually upholding the sanctity and honor of sex in marriage to the point of commanding the husband and wife to selflessly serve one another in it. In other words, don't read this and imagine that marriage was made for all those who simply couldn't control their sexual sinful passions. That's not true, because sex in marriage was deemed very good by God before the fall. Listen, if you cannot control your lusts in your singleness right now, that's never a good thing, okay? That's never a good thing, and it's called idolatry, and it's called sin, and it is a liability to your marriage. It's not the reason you should go get married. Let's make that very clear. I just give you one passage we don't have time to look at, but write it down, that proves this for us. 1 Thessalonians 4 tells us plainly that if you don't know how to possess your own body in sanctification and honor and not in lustful passion, then you're not ready to love. You don't love like you should. You actually love yourself. That's the context of 1 Thessalonians 4. And we can look at that at some point down the road, but just write it down for now. So what is Paul saying here then? Instead, Paul is simply saying that there are some people who, like himself, by God's enabling grace, can do without the intimacy of marriage and choose to remain that way for the purpose of undistracted service to Christ. And by the way, there are actually, like I noted earlier, three different categories of single people in this passage: widows, unmarried, and virgins. I don't know if you've ever thought about this. Do a study on 1 Corinthians 7. It's fascinating. There are actually three categories of single people in this passage: widows, unmarried, and virgins. The most confusing one of those categories to us is the unmarried, right? We hear that and we think, that's me. I'm not married. But I would actually argue that's not what Paul has in mind here. If you've never been married, you would actually be in the category of virgins. The unmarried, we need to realize, is a term that Paul uses specifically here in this context that is different from widows in verse 8. Notice it's listed alongside widows in verse 8. And it's different from virgins in verse 34. It's listed alongside virgins in verse 34. So you have virgins and widows, and then this other separate category of the unmarried. So who are those? While virgin is never before been married, the unmarried are those who have, they have, I just lost it in my notes. Oh, here we go. Who have been released from their marriage, verse 27, by a means other than death, since that would be a widow. Why is this important? Because notice the verse that everyone uses to justify marriage when they're struggling to have self-control over their sinful lusts is actually only used for those two categories of single people who've been married before. Look at verses 8 and 9. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, he leaves the virgin out of that. He leaves you out of it. If you've never been married, he leaves you out of that. He only talks about the two categories of single people who've been married before. That if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And with passion here is in italics, if you're reading the New American Standard. It's actually not in the original text. So listen. For those of you who've never been married before, you can't directly apply this to yourselves. This is for those who have already, listen, and it makes perfect sense. This is for those who've already given themselves to a one flesh union in every way, who in God's providence have now suddenly somehow, for some reason, been removed and released from that, whether by death as a widow or biblical divorce. The point for our series here on dating then is that if you decide that you want to date, you should be doing so because you desire all that is involved in a biblical marriage. But if you decide that you don't want that, you need to understand what you're essentially saying, that you have this gift of singleness that Paul describes here, and you are choosing to be a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven. Which means God has given you then first a unique ability to go without the intimacy of marriage and remain celibate. And second, that you are desiring to spend your singleness for the Lord in ways married people cannot. And that second category, well, both of those categories are critical in defining what Paul specifically means here and what we specifically mean when we speak of this gift of singleness. Now, while this, we might call it permanent gift of singleness, is unique and the exception rather than the rule, let me hasten to say this then. I do believe that at some point in everyone's life, we all have the, not permanent gift of singleness maybe, but the providential gift of singleness for a season before God gives many of us the gift of marriage. And I would argue that for you, that's probably most of you, in that season, the same principles apply. Listen, you need to exercise self-control. And you need to maximize your life for the service of Christ. Because the reality is, listen, you can't know definitively if you are going to be given the gift of marriage until it actually happens to you, right? You could be providentially single for the rest of your life. And then you would look back on your life and say, well, I was given the gift of singleness. So in the meantime, beloved, maximize your singleness for the Lord. Now is not time to waste. There are opportunities that you have that I had when I was in college and at my previous church that I don't have now as a married man with wife and kids. That's just the reality. That's not to say anything bad about my situation now. I love it. And it's a grace from God to minister to the souls who are actually in my home and under my care. And in that sense, I have opportunities that you don't at this moment as single people. But nevertheless, it is true as single people in God's providence, you guys, you have opportunities for ministry that I don't have. Listen to the advice that one author, Marshall Siegel, gives to single people in his book, Not Yet Married. He says, say yes to the spontaneous then. If that's you, here's just one way in which you can meet needs the way married people can't. He says, say yes to the spontaneous. It's just a fact. Marriage murders spontaneity, not entirely, but massively, okay? One of your greatest spiritual gifts as a single person is your yes. Yes to a random phone conversation. Yes to coffee. Yes to help with the move. Yes to stepping in when someone's sick. Yes, you have the unbelievable freedom to say yes when married people can't even ask the question. When the spouse doesn't exist yet, you cannot hurt him or her with the selfless, impulsive decisions you make to serve others. If you get married, you will not always have that same freedom. Being willing to say yes and be a blessing to others, even when you don't always feel like it. Guys, maximize your singleness then. I imagine Paul, you just think about him, for instance, would not have been able to do what he did had he been married. Not to mention, Jesus was not married. So at the end of the day, we can conclude this much. Listen, singleness is not a lesser existence, nor is it a problem that needs to be fixed. If you continue to see it that way, then be careful, because you could be creeping marriage into this area of idolatry. And your contentment in your singleness is being threatened. Like marriage, singleness is a gift from God to be used for His glory, and to view it this way helps us to be content with whatever circumstance God has providentially placed us in. It also helps us to pursue whatever we think we desire for the right biblical reasons. For the right reasons. Not just because you want to get out of a trial, the trial of your singleness. Okay? So remember, romantic relationships are not essential to the Christian life. As if you can't win the battle against sin without marriage. That's not true. Guys, that's a lie. Even on the front of battling sexual lust and temptation, you can win that battle without being married. It's possible. Jesus did it. Marriage is not an outlet for your sinful lusts. No, whether you're single or married, you must remain pure. And God has given you all the resources you need to do just that in either condition. So make sure your desire for marriage are for the right reasons. Now, as soon as I say that, I know at least some of you are wondering then, what are the right reasons? And that's what we're getting to. What are the right reasons? What is the role of attraction, even physical attraction? Wow. I don't know if I should do this one. I'm going to have to exercise some self-control here. All right, this will get you to come back next time. We're going to have to put a pause on this, but I'll tell you where I'm going with this, okay? I'll at least give you the title of this next one. We ask the question all the time, how do I know if my desire for a relationship is a reflection of God's Genesis 2:18 hardwiring and not just evidence of some selfish lust? Well, this next principle will help us in that, and that is this. And you can write it down. We'll fill it out next time. And in fact, we'll fill it out the next few times, because the rest of the principles that come are going to fall under this one, okay? And that is this. Romantic relationships are built on character, Christian character, not chemistry, compatibility, or charm. And that's going to be one of the toughest ones. We're going to have to flesh out what that looks like, because look, the reality is we need to be sure we're actually attracted to the right things. And that's what we'll talk about in general and then also specifically. So, all right. Well, we have time. Do you have any questions on what I just taught? Let me turn the recording off, and then you can ask away.